Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Of course, I'm not against preventing crime, but the idea that we fund things and call it crime prevention, instead of saying everybody should have freedom from want, everybody should be entitled, we're a rich enough country that every single person in this country could be fed, clothed, housed, and educated. We would have resources because we wouldn't have to put people in prison, we wouldn't be institutionalizing them in other ways, and we could focus the resources, limited resources, more limited resources, on those who, you know, who truly are causing a risk to public safety.
That's the voice of Kim Pate, Executive Director of the Elizabeth Fry Society. On this week's show, we speak to Kim about the misspent priorities in Canadian society and about the appalling human rights violations that are still going on just under the surface. Also, stay tuned for a brief interview at the end with Michael Geist, speaking about how trade agreements will affect Canadian copyright content laws. So stay tuned.
I'm very privileged this morning. I'm joined by Kim Pate. She is a Canadian Associate of Elizabeth Fry Societies. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Now, as a lawyer, teacher, you wore many hats in the advocacy of women, particularly women who have been criminalized and in prison. Can we talk a little bit about the legal system and its role in colonization? Because I think this is at the root of all our problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, we see very much that the legal system, I mean, Aboriginal people, in particular Indigenous people in this country, are documented from birth to death. And one of the examples I didn't use, but when the prison for women in Kingston first opened, and it was the only federal penitentiary for women, some of the first women, Aboriginal women jailed there, were jailed for not getting medical attention when they had their children. Nothing happened to their children. Their children were healthy. But the reason the women didn't get medical attention is because if they did, then the baby's birth got registered, and we all know what happened 4, 5, 6 years later is those children would become and scooped into residential schools. So women were being criminalized for acts of resistance of defending and supporting their children and trying to prevent them from being taken away and basically imprisoned in residential schools. So that legacy continues. You know, even now we still see young people ending up in the child welfare system, and then the trajectory into the movement into the criminal justice system is almost automatic in lots of places, because if there aren't sufficient resources for those young people, then they usually stay in those systems. And so this day they may be in a bed that's funded by social services, the next day they may be in a bed that's funded by treatment, the next day they may be in a bed that's actually considered a criminal justice bed because they've acted out or done something for which they could be criminalized. And people say, well, if they've done something, they should be criminalized. They should be. And I always like to point out that self-report studies show that there is virtually no adult that has not done something for which they could be criminalized. That people report, of course, people do things all the time that, you know, they probably shouldn't do. And, you know, you're more likely to be criminalized if you're more likely to come to the attention of the state. So Aboriginal young people in particular are, if they're being documented from birth to death, more likely to be monitored than kids who aren't already registered with the state. So that's the reality. We also see that in the system, who is more visible and who has the fewer opportunities to fight the system are those who are poor, women, Indigenous people in particular, but racialized individuals, and those who are really just trying to struggle to make ends meet. And so they're also vulnerable then to not being concerned about, even when they have rights, even when they have defenses, they often don't raise them because they're fearful that it'll somehow visit more problems on them. So I mentioned that women who have escaped violence, who have called the police themselves, who then end up arrested, will often plead guilty even though they should not. They were defending themselves and or their children, and yet they plead guilty because they think that that will allow them to get out faster to take care of their children. So I think we need to really be resisting these moves and say that when we've got a situation where we're pulling away services, we're cutting social services, cutting health care, especially mental health care, cutting educational services, we should be putting more of those in the community, not fewer, and then we'll see fewer people end up in the system. And so I know recently someone said, oh, I heard you're against crime prevention. I said, well, I'm not against preventing crime, but the idea that we fund things and call it crime prevention, instead of saying everybody should have freedom from want, everybody should be entitled, we're a rich enough country that every single person in this country could be fed, clothed, housed, and educated. We would have resources because we wouldn't have to put people in prison, we wouldn't be institutionalizing them in other ways, and we could focus the resources, limited resources, more limited resources, on those who, you know, who truly are causing a risk to public safety, and where we need to figure out what we need to be doing differently with them, so they don't end up continuing to cause risks to public safety. And so there are lots more creative things we could be doing.
One of the examples you used was the incarceration of Ashley Smith and the tragic end that came to. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about who was Ashley Smith and why is this case important for us to remember and what we learned from it?
Well, Ashley Smith was, she was a 15-year-old when she first went into the prison system. She was 15. She had breached probation and she was on probation for throwing crab apples at a postal worker who she believed, she'd been told, routinely delivered welfare checks, social assistance checks, late. And so she thought that wasn't fair. And so in her mind, it was, you know, exacting her own form of justice. Well, obviously, that's not condoned, and she was convicted of assault, and she was put on probation. Then she breached probation, and they took her into custody. And before they even got her to court on the breach of custody, she had pulled a fire alarm, she had resisted a strip search, she had done a number of things that, you know, we know vastly overrepresented are also women and girls being strip searched. We know that from the G20 hearings that are happening in Toronto right now, that even women who aren't criminalized, who are involved in protests, are more likely to be strip searched. And we know that's about humiliation and control. It's not about them being a risk to public safety at all. It's about really, showing a punitive response. And so in Ashley's situation, she resisted. Lots of young women do. That's often the first criminal charge they have while they're in custody, is resisting restraint or resisting a strip search or trying to, you know, get away or that sort of thing. And so she started accumulating charges. She was then put in custody, and she continued to accumulate charges, and she was kept in segregation. And then when she reached the age of 18, the province of New Brunswick applied to have her shipped into the adult system. The court agreed to put her into the adult system, and then 11 and a half months later, she died while in isolation on suicide watch, watched by five guards. And we were in the midst before that of trying to get information about her, for her, and working with her, because she couldn't get the information herself, and she had been assaulted. She had brought forth allegations of four assaults by staff on her, and only one resulted in charges. The charges, there were witnesses, only one witness came forth, and the charges ended up being dropped, and the rest of the charges didn't proceed. And in that process, we also put in requests for her, and she put in a grievance, and she asked us to get her files, and it took us over 3.5 years to get her files, and the inquest still hasn't started, and in October it'll be 5 years since she died.
Isolation, in my opinion, is a form of torture. To deny a person the right to be able to socialize with other human beings. So being a child herself, how is this possible to go under the radar, and where are her international rights under the Human Rights Charter being upheld?
Yeah, well, exactly. All of those. I mean, her charter rights here in Canada, the International Convention on the Rights of the Child, and the Convention Against Torture, to which Canada is a signatory, says that extended periods of segregation are a form of torture. And so, in fact, the United Nations Human Rights Committee has just made comment on that in their concluding observations, that we've been doing some research with the International Human Rights Group in Toronto, at the University of Toronto, and they did a report on the mental health issues for women in prison, and the UN has made note of that in their concluding observations, and said exactly that, what you just said, that basically, you know, individuals who are kept in extended periods of segregation are subject to torture. That's a torturous environment, because you go through sensory deprivation, you end up in a situation where you're mental health issues deteriorate, you develop new mental health issues often, and it becomes very, very difficult for the women who, and men and young people who have been in those circumstances, to ever get out and be able to thrive in the community afterwards.
I want to talk a little bit about the gender discrimination and the way the system seems to be biased from the beginning. So we look at sexual assault of women, violence against women, not even being classified as violence. Mm-hmm. You know, we call it domestic violence. So I wonder if you could talk about the impact of diminishing the impact of that violence on female bodies.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly an issue for a lot of feminists is the fact that we have degendered, that violence against women has been degendered and into domestic violence or family violence is another term that's used. And that really does take away that we're talking about fundamentally misogynist ideas, attitudes that get reinforced, whether it's through pornography. It's why I was raising it here at Civil Liberties, is, you know, that it is important what gets promoted, because certain saying everybody has free speech means that it's also free to discriminate, and we don't accept that as a starting point and say that, you know, if we truly want to have a substantively equal society, then you have to provide different opportunities and different supports for individuals, and whether that's women, racialized groups, lesbian, gay individuals, couples, family constellations, and certainly people with mental health issues, particularly women who end up in the system or who have developed mental health issues because they're institutionalized or victimized, or develop addiction issues because they're trying to cope with those issues. So, you know, we do have to look very clearly at those policies and the fact that on the one hand, we tell women to call the police and then the police don't respond, or they do respond ineffectively, or they respond in a way that is and reinforces that misogyny. What message does that give to the men who are abusing them, and or them and or their children? It is that you can do it with impunity. So the law has not kept pace with, even though in theory it has, with the fact that if a woman is going to defend herself, it may mean she has to take preemptive action to defend herself when she knows is a very real risk. And then when they do act to protect themselves, that we respond by criminalizing and trying to jail them.
As we see the world increasing with insecurity, the economic crisis, the climate crisis that we all face now, we see the feminization, and not just of violence, but also of poverty, mm-hmm. The increasing erosion of benefits for workers. And I wonder if you could talk about the relationship between poverty and the criminalization of women's bodies.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly we've seen the increased feminization of poverty and the criminalization of poverty. I don't think it's accidental that it's mostly poor women who are seeing in that situation. It's mostly women, I should say, and that's disproportionately women who are heading poor families, and whether it's working poor or because they're on social assistance and they're trying to manage. And nowhere else is, except in the social services scenario, is a debt considered income. Like, can you imagine if to the middle, with the rise up of the middle and upper classes, if in fact their mortgages were all considered, our mortgage, you know, because I have one too, it was considered income, and we got taxed on debt as though it was income. And people are, you know, appalled. People who are representing women who are in for or being charged with fraud on welfare don't even understand that's happening. If I'm on social assistance and I borrow money, that's considered income. When I pay it back, it's not considered anything. I don't get any credit for it. So it's a no-win situation. It's a constant driving of the individuals into more deeper multi-generational poverty that is harder and harder to ever, you know, well-nigh impossible to ever extricate yourself from. And that's a very gendered issue. I mean, it's disproportionately women who are relying on social services. And so somehow it's disproportionately women who are committing fraud. I don't think so. Why don't we charge the state? Why, in Kim Rogers' case, we talked about the individuals who made decisions about bringing those policies in should be charged with murder. It was intentional. They knew that people couldn't survive on that amount of money. Why aren't those people who are causing harm by, whether it's decisions like allowing fewer environmental supports, less access to medical attention, you know, why don't we define that as the harm that's causing the greatest challenges to all of us, both in terms of social and personal harm, but also fiscal harm to all of us.
When we look at the world today, equally we also see a response from the people. Those who are most marginalized are also standing up, whether it's Africa, Tunisia, Latin America. In Honduras, they call it the landless movement, you know, throughout Brazil. They're taking the lands and actually starting to grow crops, grow food, educate themselves. And there's a move to occupy the state effectively because the state as it exists today does not represent people. Do you think we're at that moment in Canada? And what will it take to occupy Ottawa?
Yeah, well, I think we're at that moment in Quebec, certainly the students and all the supporters. I mean, when you see the police taking off their riot masks and walking in solidarity with the protesters and banging pots and all of that, I think that's incredible. And so I think there's moments and places we are. Sadly, I think there are many people who don't believe, you know, in fact, one of my law students had the courage a few years ago to say that she, until she went into the prison and saw some of the conditions herself, saw a woman fully shackled with her breasts, you know, hanging out because the suicide gown she was in didn't even fully cover her body because they're the same size, whether it's for men or for women. And until she saw those things, she said she really believed I exaggerated all the stories. And so, to her credit, she actually said that. I know many people must think that, and most people in Canada believe that we don't have these kinds of human rights abuses. And so one of the challenges is that being a country that has the laws that we have, there are many who believe that they're not violated. In fact, that's not accurate. We know that they are violated. And, some of our colleagues in South Africa have talked about the same sort of problems dealing with racism. After the so-called fall of apartheid, there's a belief that there's no more racism in South Africa, as if that could be true. And similarly, there's a lot of people here believe we've got the charter, so there aren't those kinds of human rights and charter violations happening in Canada. So I hope we're at that moment. I think we will be at that moment. And I see young people, whether it's my own children and their friends and others, really clearly understanding, and as you know, Cindy Blackstock said so well, clearly understanding it's wrong, and there's something really amiss. And you know, some of the rest of us who are a bit older, perhaps haven't caught on as well yet, but hopefully will. So yeah, I have great hope that that'll happen for sure.
What inspires you to keep doing the work you do?
Oh, the incredible people I have the privilege of working with. I mean, the women and young people and the men before who I've worked with, who, you know, I see their integrity, their will, their incredible courage, incredible generosity of spirit, and strength. And I think that inspires me. And so there's times, absolutely, I'll sometimes describe that I vibrate between rage and despair sometimes. And you know, when you see injustice, you want to do something about it. And so I think that that's really, you know, and I have children. You know, many of the elders talk about we do the work for the seven generations to come. I think we have to keep doing this work. We owe it to our children, their children, and I don't mean just my biological children, but, you know, the generations coming to leave this world a better place than we entered it.
Elizabeth Fry Association has been at the forefront fighting for the rights of people who have been criminalized and imprisoned. Can you talk a little bit about this work and how can people join in?
Sure. I've been with Elizabeth Fry for more than 20 years because I was involved with one of the local Elizabeth Fry societies before that. But in terms of the work, the work is changes and is different across the country. I work in the national office, but in the local societies, they'll do everything from sometimes they're the only victim services. They may be operating a shelter or support service, or they go into prisons, and it ranges depending on where they are. And so on our website, which is elizabethfry.ca, my kids tell me I sound like a nerd when I say www, but so I guess I don't have to say that anymore. Oh, I just did, but anyway. So it's elizabethfry.ca. All the member societies are listed on the website, the addresses and contact people, so people can get involved by looking on the website, seeing which one is closest to them, and, you know, checking out whether they want to volunteer, they'd like to be on the board of directors, if there's jobs coming up, and get involved that way. And also, we work in alliance with many other groups, whether it's groups doing anti-racism work, groups doing anti-poverty work, gay and lesbian community, groups, obviously criminal justice and social justice groups. And we do that work to try and work in coalition on these issues. So there's lots of potential. And if you don't have time to do those things, then certainly on our website we have posted posters and postcards, and you can download them, share them with your friends. We have a Facebook page, and there's also a sister Facebook page. I think it's called Citizens for Social and Fiscal Accountability. So there's that, and basically there's no end of the ways people can contribute and participate and enrich our work as well. So we'd look forward to all of that.
If you had your wish and there were three things that would, you know, incredibly transform not just the way we conceive of crime, but the way we improve the quality of life for all people, what would you hope that we would do differently?
You know, I mentioned that the heads of corrections back in the mid-90s said we could release 75% of prisoners right now and not increase risk to public safety. I think one really concrete thing, I mean, obviously I'd like to see it much bigger than that, but one very concrete thing is to say, let's do that as a starting point and not have those dollars stay in the criminal justice system, but move out and be used for public housing, support services, health services, educational services, and, you know, have a national child care program like we should have supports for women who are struggling, who want to either set up their own co-op, businesses, whatever, recreation opportunities, educational opportunities for kids. I mean, there's many, many things we could be doing differently with those resources. That's a lot of money to spend to lock people up who eventually, unless they die in prison, are likely to come out back into the community. And if we just keep pulling all those resources out of the community to put people, more and more people in prison, then we'll have fewer resources for everyone, including those individuals who are going to come back to, you know, an increasingly remote and barren in terms of social services and education and support services. So I think that's for sure number one, that we should focus there. We could be enlisting the support of women and children and people who are currently in incredible marginalized situations to focus on the environment and focus on really creating the world we want to live in, not continuing to you know, essentially rape and pillage Mother Earth and leave us with few opportunities to survive. And then, you know, encourage everybody to have the ability to self-actualize, to live to the greatest potential and contribute to their communities. And I think one of the things I really like about the Occupy movement, I mean, when I visited them in Toronto, in Ottawa, and in New York, what was wonderful to see is people who are on the street, people who might have mental health issues, people who have addiction issues, being cared for, taken care of, always having a place to sleep, always having a meal, and being supported, and watched some of those individuals for the first time feel that they were valued and that they could contribute to that community. And I think that's a great lesson that those, you know, mostly young people have taught us. So I think that we should take leadership as we can from the young people and from those who have the lived experience and follow their lead, because they're giving us very wise counsel and we often don't follow it.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for this, and thank you for your show. It was wonderful.
I am joined by Dr. Michael Geist. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, the discussion around internet and the role of social media in social movements, what is your hopes and what are some of the barriers we face at this moment?
I'm hugely positive about the impact that it can have. And I think we've seen in recent months and in years that it can give voice to a lot of people that previously either didn't know how they could become more politically engaged or engaged on different policies, or didn't realize that there were many people who thought the same kinds of things they were thinking. And so this develops communities around issues. It gives them, I think, far more influence and power over issues than was previously the case. And while there are always concerns about misuse when it comes to things like social media, I'm a big optimist when it comes to the potential that many of these sorts of tools have to ensure that many citizens that previously found themselves limited in terms of what they could do have far more impact than was previously the case.
When we look at governments making trade agreements and agreements that are over encompassing our own autonomy as a citizen, what are some of the concerns you have with trade agreements that include copyright and issues of surveillance?
It's not appropriate to include within these broad trade agreements intellectual property rules generally. And I think we've actually had Canadian parliamentary committees that have concluded that future agreements shouldn't have intellectual property provisions. We've seen that with the European Parliament. We've seen in other countries like Australia that have come to the same conclusion. And I think the simple reason is that you can make an argument for certain trade agreements where we're talking about lowering the barriers and improving trade, although, of course, there's lots of different opinions even about the benefits of those kinds of deals. But once you start getting into intellectual property policy around patents that can increase the cost of medicines, about copyright that can really decrease, I think, the kind of opportunities that many Canadians have to express themselves, not to mention the consumer impact. We're talking about things that really don't belong in trade agreements at all. And they're by and large just an attempt to impose a certain regulatory framework from one country into another. And I think most countries are actually on the defensive in this regard, developed and developing. And so my view is the Canadian government, certainly in the agreements it initiates, because it's doing a lot of trade agreements right now, should say we don't want to include IP as part of what we're doing. And where IP is there because the United States or Europe is pushing for it, they need to push back and say, we think there's plenty of good reasons, if there are, for having this agreement. Intellectual property just doesn't belong here.
Where are the battles that we need to be fighting right now? We have a government that seems to be riding pretty much on its own authority and it's not listening to people. So what are some of the battles that we have to be engaging in as citizens?
Well, you know, we have had some success. We had it on the internet surveillance legislation. So the government did listen, I think, to some of that pressure. And it evolved its thinking a little bit on copyright. And again, I think listen to some of the things Canadians had to say. My concern now is around trade agreements with Europe, with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, where many of the things we were able to fight against in those other agreements because they simply were unfair, may enter through the back door, so to speak, through these trade agreements. And there it's a tougher battle to fight because you've got so many other issues that are in play. The government may say, well, we don't love the IP provisions, but we're going to go with them because we like some of the other sorts of things. I think we need to take a strong stand and say if there are big risks to our healthcare costs, as is the case in CETA, in the European Trade Agreement, if there are big risks to extending term of copyright and locking down content for Canadians, as is the case in the TPP, we simply have to say we won't be part of those agreements if those are the kinds of provisions that are included.
On October 1st, 2011, the government signed the ACTA. Can you tell us what this is and why we should be concerned about it?
Sure. So ACTA is the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement and took several years to negotiate, largely in secret. It would reshape many of the rules under Canadian copyright law. We've seen in Europe huge protests, thousands of people taking to the streets against it because of concerns about the privacy implications, the free speech implications. And I think at the end of the day, fundamentally saying that agreements like this that are conducted in secret can't stand. And that even if this were a fair and appropriate agreement, the way in which it was crafted is enough to disqualify it, and that we shouldn't be rewarding those kinds of agreements by signing on. We're seeing Europe reject it. The Mexican Senate has said no. The Swiss government has said no. Netherlands has said no. There are many countries now that are saying no. Canada has signed, but I think there's still an opportunity for it to see this momentum that's taking place elsewhere, to recognize that this agreement is ultimately going to be seen more for what not to do as opposed to what to do, and to say that they're backing out as well.
Who does this agreement stand to profit?
Well, I think the benefits largely accrue to the United States and some of those large content industries. They were the ones that pushed for it in the first place. They're the ones that are still pushing for it. And so clearly they're the primary intended beneficiaries.
Thank you so much for being with us. How can our audience reach out your work, learn more about these issues?
Well, thanks. So I'm online at michaelgeist.ca, michaelgeist.ca. And I'm on Twitter at mgeist.
Thank you again for being with us.
Great. Thank you.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.